Got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Folta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Cameron with you here as always. Kevin is out this week, and we actually have a new co-host. I'm very excited to introduce her. Her name's Allie Kennedy, and she's just going to be sitting in this one time for Kevin and fielding my questions the way he normally does, and I'm going to let her introduce herself. So, Allie, tell people a little bit about yourself, how you got into this science communication stuff, and what your research interests are.
Sure. So I'm a pre-medical student. I'm in my last semester here at the University of Florida. And I was in Dr. Folta's plant molecular biology class. And he said, hey, let's do some research together regarding COVID-19. So that's kind of how I started getting involved in communications. Then Kevin put me in touch with Cameron. Then Cameron put me in touch with the Genetic Literacy Project, where I do a little work now there too. But my primary research project is actually about the neurology of osteoarthritis, and I look at pain genetics in that sphere.
Very cool stuff. So you know lots of science things, and if I'm not mistaken, you're on the road to be a doctor one day, is that right?
Yep, that's correct. So I'm hoping to be an infectious disease specialist later on, but I got to survive the MCAT first.
Well, good luck, because I don't think I could. So so let's all give Allie some snaps and wish her good luck.
Oh, yes, please.
Well, with that out of the way, let's jump into the stories for today. We've got some good ones, and they're all about infectious disease and, of course, COVID-19, because that's still on everybody's mind. So first up, debating the possible origins of COVID-19, a lab-escaped bioweapon, animal poop, or random mutations in an existing virus. Next up, making the leap from no to yes. Here's why some people who were vaccine skeptics ultimately got their shots. And then finally, it looks like the 10-day pause on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine back in April discouraged a lot of people from getting any COVID-19 vaccine. So we're going to dive into the data on that. But first up, let's look at the origins of SARS-CoV-2. This has been a really controversial topic. And I remember initially at the beginning of the pandemic, the idea was this was just a virus of natural origin. It showed up in this wet market in Wuhan, China, and jumped from bats to pangolins, and then it infected us. And then here we are a year later, I think a few million people have died now in the US. It's just about 600,000. So it's been crazy, right? So it appears, though, that there are some competing hypotheses these days. So there, of course, there is this natural hypothesis that people are speculating about, but there's also the idea of a lab leak. Now, initially, this was sort of a conspiracy theory. It was posited by people like Alex Jones and different people on YouTube and the internet more generally, who were saying, you know, China leaked this or the US leaked this, or, you know, it's a big kind of a global conspiracy. And then there's this third idea that was relatively, or at least it was new to me, this idea of mutator genes that trigger other mutations somewhere down the line in the virus, and that causes it to become more virulent and more dangerous to humans. So as far as I understand, Allie, there's really no clear answer yet. I think Science Magazine came out just a couple weeks ago, and they said, like, we don't really know. I mean, the World Health Organization has investigated this, but they didn't really look at the lab leak hypothesis very thoroughly. So we need to get to the bottom of this. So can you fill in some of the details and tell us about each of these? And let's go in order. So let's start with the idea that this is just it's a natural virus. It jumped from one animal to another, and then it got to us. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So first of all, I think it is really difficult to definitively say, yeah, this was the origin of SARS-CoV-2. And for a lot of viruses that are even more prolific, like, for example, when we're looking at Ebola virus, we have been totally unable to link Ebola virus back to the original bat vector. They think it's a bat, that lives in the wild. So it's not always so easy to say, okay, this is the vector, this is how it mutated, and this is how it approached human territory, right? So, but the when we follow that hypothesis that this is something that naturally arose, there's a couple of different ways that that can happen. So you mentioned about the mutator gene. So basically why the mutator gene thing is important is because it explains why such a rapid evolution would have occurred in this virus. So a mutator gene basically is just referring to a downstream gene. So something that's, let's just say, far away from the gene that actually affects the spike protein, that affects the virulence of COVID-19. Something changes in that faraway gene that makes that spike protein more effective. And so mutator genes can be amplified. You can have multiple mutator genes, and that'll cause a more rapid type of evolution like we saw in the very sudden transfer of COVID-19 from an animal to the human population. So that kind of is the overview of the mutator gene hypothesis. And then more simply is the idea that this was a virus that existed in some kind of natural vector. The idea is bat vectors. And bats are fantastic vectors for viruses of all kinds. You know, rabies, we think for Ebola, they carry a lot of viruses. So it's a very valid hypothesis to say that this was a virus that existed in bats for a long time and then mutated and mutated and mutated until it could make the jump to people.
Okay, so that's the idea that this is just a naturally occurring virus. It sounds like we still have a lot to learn about that too, but I was under the impression that the idea of a lab leak was a conspiracy. I mean, that's the way it was reported early in the pandemic. It seemed that most experts that I know said, you know, this is sort of a fringe idea. I mean, maybe it's true, but in the last, I'd say, I don't know, maybe 6 months, it's become more legitimate, I suppose. You know, there are more scientists and more foreign policy experts who know a lot about China saying, you know, this wouldn't be out of character for a country like that to do something like this. And we really need to seriously investigate what's going on here. So tell us a little bit about the possibility that this actually did escape from a lab somehow.
Sure. So I think firstly, the politics of it are important, you know, and it is a sensational idea to say the Chinese government was trying to develop some kind of super weapon that was leaked from this laboratory. It's like a movie plot, right? So people tend to look at that and say, that sounds a little bit of a conspiracy idea, you know, but when we look at how China really did approach the beginnings of the pandemic, there was a lot of, you know, altered information coming out of China as to death tolls, as to the true risk, which is something that happens with governments occasionally. It's just the information doesn't come out exactly how it's actually reported. So I think that it's something that should be heavily considered, you know, because we just simply don't know, and it's really difficult to know. So in this article, actually, they present on the, okay, let's go down the cognitive idea that it's something that was released from a laboratory. There's this really interesting report, and the article says this report went on to later be eviscerated, I think was the word, by popular sources. But it's called the Yan Report, and it basically says that the predecessor, the natural predecessor that the Chinese government reported as being the what COVID-19 mutated from, they say that was a made-up virus. The sequence of DNA was literally just forged and put into GenBank to cover the Chinese Communist Party's ass, right? So that's kind of what this report is saying. But it does have some very interesting points. So one of the interesting points I thought the Yan Report brings up, if everything in the Yan Report is to be believed, is that the RATG13, the predecessor, the natural predecessor to COVID-19, was discovered in 2013, but it wasn't sequenced until 2020, right? So it wasn't put into GenBank until 2020. Another interesting thing about that RATG13 sequence is that it's you can't verify it independently. So the question you might have is, well, if it was just made up, why can't we take it from the natural source and sequence it? And that's because none of it is retained. So we don't have any samples of that original viral sequence. It was all destroyed or degraded. So there are some interesting points. And then finally, the Yan Report goes on to say, so there was an alternate article that was published like almost at the exact same time as the RATG13 report that said, you know, there's these viruses that have been looked at by the Chinese military for a while, and those are the predecessors. And, you know, then it goes on to say, so that lab was like shut down, like the article was expunged from the earth. So this is kind of what the Yon report is saying. To summarize, it's just saying that the natural predecessor to COVID-19 didn't exist in the wild and it was totally fabricated. The other side of the argument was this other fantastic report called the Proximal Origin Report that goes on to explain why it could not have been a lab-developed virus.
And I want to get back into the Yon report, but I think their basic argument was the virus is so haphazardly constructed, in quotes, that any competent engineer wouldn't have done it this way, right? If you wanted to make something to kill people, you would have fine-tuned this thing, and SARS-CoV-2 is not. Is that the basic of their argument?
So yeah, that's the basics of the Proximal Origin Report, which is the one that's kind of supporting, okay, this did not come from a lab. The Yon report is like, this came from a lab, like there's no way it came from anywhere else. But you're right. So the Proximal Origin Report's explanation basically says SARS-CoV-2 has high affinity for human cells. It bonds to that ACE2 receptor with relatively high affinity. But if we really wanted to manufacture a super weapon, we would have one that was way more efficient than that. And there have been viruses kind of manipulated in labs to have a much higher efficiency for that. So that is a point against that bioweapon theory. Another interesting point against the bioweapon theory is that there's this coronavirus in the pangolin family that is remarkably similar to SARS-CoV-2, but with that same low affinity that we see, well, relatively low affinity compared to a manufactured superweapon, right? But it shows a lot of convergent evolution that's happening in the coronavirus family. And so I think that spotting that in other species in the same kind of area is a very strong point to say this is something that's been, you know, was a ticking time bomb that was bound to, you know, convergently evolve into something that was going to make the jump to humans. And finally, that report also goes on to say that they go into all a bunch of genetic jargon here that I can't fully understand because I'm not a geneticist. But they basically go on to say there's no other previously used viral backbone that matches the genetic data from SARS-CoV-2.
Yeah. Now, speaking of movies, this sounds like it would be a really cool movie. You know,
yeah.
Like you have like two sides of a hypothesis or two different sides of an argument, each with its own hypothesis, saying, you know, this is the way it happened. No, this is the way it happened. And I'm on May 14th, Science Magazine, for those of you who aren't aware, is probably the number one or number two science journal in the world. They published a letter from several researchers from around the world. And this is a quote. They said, greater clarity about the origins of this pandemic is necessary and feasible to achieve. We must take hypotheses about both natural and laboratory spillovers seriously until we have sufficient data. So this is just less than 2 weeks ago. We have really eminent researchers in a very, very prominent journal saying, we just don't know. There's valid evidence on both sides. So we really have to investigate this. So maybe and tell me your thoughts on this, Allie, maybe the best way to go forward is to say, look, we need to be humble. We need to research all the possibilities and then just go through a process of elimination. And we really can't say, you know, the lab leak is a conspiracy theory for Alex Jones and his fans and the natural hypothesis. That's the true sciencey one. You know, we just have to step back. What do you think?
So I think that the early condemnation of the bioweapon theory was probably kind of short-sighted. And I think, you know, at the beginning, Donald Trump was really kind of holding this anti-China rhetoric where people got a bad taste in their mouth of people saying, hey, you know, the Chinese government built this. And so I think it was very quickly denounced. I think that there's valid information, though, to be had on that front. And we know that the Chinese government lied about several features of the early coronavirus pandemic. So I think it's really important to take all options into consideration when we're searching for this origin, because it's a hard enough search as it is without arbitrarily crossing out options, you know? So I think it's good that we're coming back around to saying, all right, let's view this as a legitimate option and not this politicized kind of taboo topic.
Yeah, good stuff. And by the way, I would encourage everyone to read that article. That was by Ricky Lewis in the Genetic Literacy Project. Unlike both of us, she is a geneticist, and she really knows this inside and out, and she really gives a great summary of every possible explanation, and she knows the literature, and she's written about this. So I highly recommend that you guys dig into that. But let's move on to this next story. This is by Dan Diamond in the Washington Post originally and reprinted at the GOP. And it's entitled, Making the Leap from No to Yes, Here's Why Vaccine Skeptics Decided to Get a Shot. And I think this is a great story because it highlights exactly why people make decisions about vaccines. And so, for example, just to give a couple examples, he documents that it could be anything from wanting to go to Yankees games again, you know, for people in New York City, to a mother who's concerned about her daughter who has a very serious illness. You know, if I get COVID and I get really sick, who's going to take care of my daughter? And there's a vaccine available that could prevent me either from getting infected, or if I do get infected, from getting really sick. And so I can continue being a mother and caring for my child. And then for other people, it was, you know, I saw a scientist on TV who's also a doctor at the local hospital. And this in the WAPO article, it was Paul Offit, who is an infectious disease specialist at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. So one of his patients saw him on TV and she's like, hey, I know that guy. He takes care of my kids. And so based on that, she said, you know, OK, he says the vaccines are good. The vaccines are good. So I'm going to go get the shot. So that's the first point, is that, you know, the reasons people get vaccines or don't get vaccines, they're varied. You know, the process is different for everyone. Everybody's incentives are different. And the biggest thing, and this is not surprising, it's that it comes down to trust in scientists and doctors. So if they see these people talking on TV, maybe they know them from their community, that influences their decision. But just to briefly sum it up, it just comes down to a personal decision. It's very complex, and this is human psychology. You know, we're not lab rats. You can't put us in the laboratory and prod us and try to figure out in a controlled experiment what's going to work. So it's a tough subject to cover, but I think the story very nicely summarizes how people make these decisions. But what were your thoughts on this story, Ellie?
So I think that often it feels like there's a really stark divide between people who are fully anti-vaccine and then people that say everyone should get vaccinated, you know, but in reality, there's a lot of people that are on the fence that have reasonable doubts that also see the benefits. And it's pretty interesting to me how this listed a lot of the reasons why people decided to get it. It just kind of goes to show that any small thing can be the decider that pushes someone into getting a vaccine. So I think as scientists, it's easy for us to forget that something, it's as simple as a Yankees game, you know, to get people to want to get the vaccine.
Yeah. I guess the way I would sum it up, because I'm sort of an economics geek, is that incentives matter, you know? So if you can take into consideration what motivates people, then you're going to have a better, you know, better time convincing them to do something you want them to do. And in this case, it's a vaccine. And one thing I would add, and I think this goes back to the last comment you made on our last story, is that I think it's a good idea to get away from partisan politics when you're talking about vaccine hesitancy. For one thing, it's not widespread, but it is spread out across different demographic groups. So people of all different backgrounds and ethnicities and political opinions are vaccine hesitant for various different reasons. And I've seen lately in the media, they will target one particular group and they'll say, this is the group that, you know, vaccine hesitancy is a big thing in this community. So we really need to focus on that. And I think in reality, that just alienates those people, and it ignores the fact that there are other people that are hesitant as well, and you're not addressing their concerns because you're just focused on this one group of people. So that's a really important point. I think there's some literature behind that we can get into, but maybe we don't have the time. But what are your thoughts? I mean, do you think is there a justification for saying, you know, this particular group is not going along, or do you think we need to step away from the politics a little bit?
So in my opinion, I think that the polarization is entirely unhelpful. I think that trying to categorize and target people based on their demographic for not wanting to get a vaccine is really unhelpful. And I think the most important thing is to realize that we're all people and we need to take it case by case. And people that are, even people on the far anti-vax spectrum, like way, way away from wanting to get a vaccine. Those people think that way for a reason. And there's discussions that should be had. There's reasons for doubt. There's reasons for enthusiasm. And I think it should be taken case by case. You know, I don't think that generalizations help. And I really think that polarization has made things really, really difficult to move forward as a unified society with this pandemic.
Yeah, it's been frustrating for sure. And just an example to follow up on that, I know a good friend of mine who was in the Army for a long time. And when he first got in, they were, you know, they require a certain number of shots. And for one of them, he said, I have an allergy to something in this shot. And they said, you know, whatever, roll up your sleeve. Let's get this done.
Right.
So they made him get it. And he had nothing fatal or serious, but he had a bad reaction to the vaccine, and then he survived and went on with his life. But for the rest of his life now, he is adamant that he's like, I'm not getting any of these shots. I don't care what they are until I'm 100% certain that they're safe and that they're not going to have any unintended consequences for me or for my kids. So as a result of that one incident, you know, you have a whole family who is now vaccine skeptical.
Yeah.
So it's a great, I mean, you can comment on that too, but it's a great example of, I think, why you need to accept people's concerns and take them seriously instead of just kind of calling them quacks.
Right. No, I think it's really important. And as somebody who's on the pre-med track, listening to your patients is huge. But on the topic of the military, you know, it's so divided right now for should vaccines be mandated, should they not against corona? And, you know, I had a family member who said, you know, her husband's in the military and the sergeant said, you know, you have to get this or we're going to chapter you out of the Army, you know, but that wasn't really the truth, right? It was like playing telephone from high command because there's not a lot of organization in the military right now about should we require it, should we not? So it's kind of an interesting thing because there are a ton of requirements, required vaccines for servicemen. And so that's an interesting topic itself.
Yeah, that's crazy, you know? And I mean, I don't want to, not that we're going to solve that issue, but I think it does underscore the point. One final thing I'll say before we move on to our last story, and I think it's key to mention this, is that the cases are still dropping in the U.S. I mean, globally, COVID-19 infections are a big problem. Everyone's heard about India. And of course, you have these variants floating around that the vaccines do work against, but there's always the possibility that one pops up that the vaccines don't protect against, you know, so it is a real problem. But I do want to stress that in the U.S. vaccine uptake is still pretty good. And in fact, the CDC said just earlier today, no, 2 days ago, excuse me, the U.S. can be, quote, cautiously optimistic as COVID cases and deaths fall. And that's primarily due to the vaccines. Now, natural immunity plays a part in that as well. But things are on the upswing, I guess. So I don't want any of these stories to suggest to people that we're all about to die.
Sure. 'Cause
that's not the case, you know. So we're doing pretty good with all that said. But let's move on to this last story. And I think this is an interesting one because it's sort of, this is the kind of thing that can threaten the progress that we're making. So this one is by Julie Warnow in the Wall Street Journal. And this is called "A Scientifically Questionable 10-Day Pause of J&J Vaccine Has Deepened Vaccine Hesitancy." And this is a really, really interesting one. So just to recap the facts, because I'm sure most of you guys know this, but some may not. So Johnson & Johnson's COVID vaccine shot was authorized in February by the FDA. And from what I've read about it, people were inclined to take it because it's a single shot. So you don't, like for the mRNA shot that I got, I had to go back once, then I had to go back 3 or 4 weeks later and get a second one. And the second one was hell because it was basically like getting flu for a couple of days. Now, I survived because I'm talking to you, but you know, it was a multi-step process. And ideally I would not have liked to like have to take a day off work and, you know, be sweating on my couch for a day, but you know, it is what it is. But with the J&J shot, that wasn't really a factor because you just had to get it once. And it was easy to store in terms of the temperature. It didn't have to be kept at sub-zero temperatures, I don't believe. So it was easier to transport as well. So all of this made it really appealing to physicians and to healthcare providers and, of course, to patients. But then in April, and again, this is like just not very long after the vaccine's approved, regulators came out and they said, well, we're going to pause distribution of this shot because there's a risk of rare blood clots. Now, as it turns out, you know, 10 days later, as again, most of you probably know, they said, you know, okay, this is, you know, the benefits of this shot outweigh the risks. These are really rare blood clots. And in fact, your overall or your general background risk of developing one of these blood clots is bigger, like without the shot. So it's like, if you get the shot, your risk actually goes down. If you look at the statistics, so I think that's a really interesting background for people to understand. Or if you were to contract COVID, your risk of having one of these would be bigger. So it's probably unlikely that the shot is going to give you a serious, you know, you're going to have a serious side effect to the shot. But the point is that, you know, they put this pause in effect, and this discouraged a lot of people. And again, Ali, you mentioned people who were on the fence. There were a lot of people who were leaning like, I'm just going to go get this one shot, then I'm going to go to my Yankees game, you know. But then the CDC comes out and they go, whoa, you know, we got to figure out what's going on here. And this really discouraged a lot of people, not a lot, I want to say some people, from getting a shot. And there were multiple surveys looking at this. So the Kaiser Family Foundation has done a pretty good job of tracking the vaccine response in America. And what they said about this, and I think they've done two surveys specifically related to this. They did one in March, and they did one in April, and there were several thousand people involved in each one. And basically what they showed is that from March to April, people who were inclined to get it now said, I'm probably not going to get it. And so this is a real problem. And again, I'm stressing that the numbers are going up, but if the numbers are going up, let's not chop them off at the knees with these unnecessary pauses. So Ali, I feel like this is right up your alley. That's so stupid.
Oh, Anyways, love it.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
So I do think this is a kind of a double-edged sword, right? So I think that the 10-day pause just to find out that this is as exceedingly of a rare side effect as it is, it was probably pretty damaging to a lot of people that were on the fence, like you said. Definitely. It's really hard, though, because Johnson & Johnson definitely has an ethical responsibility to say, we need to get to the bottom of this before we let people continue to take this shot, right? And I recently wrote an article about AstraZeneca, and Johnson & Johnson had a very similar kind of occurrence of clotting. And, you know, just to get into the science really quickly about it, it's this very strange type of clotting that is so strange and so linked to the vaccine itself that it has its own name. It's a syndrome called thrombosis with thrombocytopenia syndrome, and it's abbreviated TTS. But basically what that means is that you're having this atypical presentation where you have a blood clot, but counterintuitively to what you would normally see with a blood clot, you also have a low platelet count, right? So platelets are the factor of your blood that's responsible for clotting it. So why would you have a clot, but really low platelets too? So it's this, and they get down to trying to figure out why this would happen. And there's a lot of theories, so it's not very clear right now. But it is a weird enough syndrome for them to be like, this is definitely caused by the vaccine. So when you see even a tiny, tiny, tiny proportion of the population get this, I think it's important to note that it is a unique type of clotting and not just your average general population blood clot. So I think what Johnson & Johnson did to err on the side of caution and say, let's wait for 10 days, really get to the bottom of how common this is, and then kind of, I think it would have been more damaging, I mean to say, is if they didn't suspend it, and then it goes on that TTS is found to be, you know, some high proportion of the population, like, you know, 3 or 4%, when really it's much, much, much less than that this occurs in. So you could definitely look at both sides of it. And I don't think Johnson & Johnson could have picked a route that wouldn't have made people more hesitant to get vaccines. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. If you know, maybe you don't know, but is this something they could have detected in the clinical trials, or did they detect this in the clinical trials? What you know what I'm saying?
So as far as I'm aware, the only clinical trials that I really picked apart were the Pfizer vaccine. So I don't know if this was something that was detected in clinical trials, but I would say it's doubtful, because it took quite a few million doses of Johnson & Johnson to go out before, because it is such a low occurrence. And also, another thing about it is that it had to be identified as directly related to the vaccine. So it had to be identified as this specific clotting disorder and not just somebody randomly getting a cerebral venous sinus thrombosis or something like that because they already had a clotting disorder. So it takes a while to narrow those things down. And once these vaccines go, and it's true for all these vaccines, once they get distributed to the general population, there's no way that we can replicate in clinical trials millions and millions of people getting this. There's bound to be extremely rare side effects that kind of come to light. And I think more likely that's what happened.
Sure. Yeah. And one thing that keeps coming up on the show over and over, I say it almost every week, but it's like, there's just no easy answer sometimes. You know, these problems occur and you do your best to mitigate them, but they're just going to be there. And it really comes down to how you message them. So one alternative to the pause that I heard from a couple of experts, even one who used to be at the FDA, was to say, look, the risk is real, but it is minuscule. It's very, yeah, very tiny. It affects a certain segment of the population more than anybody else. And again, it's really, really rare relative to your risk of contracting this virus and getting sick or maybe even dying. You know, you're better off getting the shot. And then after you give everyone this information, you say, ultimately, it's up to you. You know, so here's the vaccine. Here's the information. It's safe for most people. Take it away, individual. You know, so what are your thoughts on that? Would that have been an appropriate strategy?
Yeah. So to that point, I think that it's really important to note that the occurrence of clotting in moderate to severe COVID-19 patients is extremely, like, way higher than the risk of getting it with a J&J vaccine and way higher than the risk of the general population getting a spontaneous thrombosis. So COVID-19 has a significant clotting risk, way more significant than the J&J vaccine. I think that's something that would have been relevant for J&J to discuss. And I think it's also a very small demographic of people that are most at risk for this. And that would be like 30s to 50s women that are on birth control and have, you know, or other types of hormone replacement. Apparently, for whatever reason, that's really the risk group. And I think one more point that's important for people to understand is that you don't get the J&J vaccine, you know, feel great, and then suddenly get a thrombosis, right? What really happens in these cases, and I've looked at the case studies, is that you get really horrible side effects. You know, you feel sick, you wind up in the hospital, and you don't get better. It's not something that spontaneously happens months down the line. So I think that's something for, you know, the fear of having the shot and then not knowing, am I going to suddenly get a brain blood clot and die? It doesn't work like that. And I think that's something that J&J should have really come out to talk about a little bit too.
Yeah, it's difficult. And again, this is a criticism I've heard from people that used to work at some of these regulatory agencies, is that the regulators themselves, they are scared of either being criticized in the media, or they're scared of, you know, some kind of political group or politicians coming after them or trying to slash their funding. And so out of an abundance of caution, and that's the actual phrase they use, they will take this step and they will pull it off the market. You know, so it may not even be that they're really concerned that there's a ton of people who are going to experience blood clots because of this. It's just that, you know, to use the phrase you used earlier, right? They're covering their own ass.
Yeah.
And I get that. It's a very natural human feeling, and it's an incentive, right? I want to keep my job. So
sure.
So I get that, but it just seems like the better way to do it would have been just to explain what's going on. But you know, I guess we're gonna live and we'll learn.
Yeah, if they had the data at the time, I think it probably would have been better to say, look, the occurrence is so low that it's really up to you whether you think the benefit of, you know, being protected against this fairly deadly, I mean, quite deadly virus in many cases is far outweighs your very minuscule risk. But I think it's also possible that they might have not had the full data at that time. So I think it really depends on how much they knew. And you're right, it could have been a politicized decision to pull it from the market.
Very good. All right, you guys. Well, I think that was a pretty darn good episode. Everyone give Ali, a round of applause when you hear this, because this is, I think, your first time on air, so to speak, on a podcast, right?
Yeah, sure. This is my first time on any podcast. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, good job. Digital high five. And as you know, we have a little tradition here of telling people who we're following on Twitter. So why don't you tell the people who you are following on Twitter?
Sure. So I think it was last week that Dr. Folta also said, hey, you should follow Dan Wilson. I think he runs the Debunk the Funk YouTube channel. I think it's awesome. His handle is at 20mandan, and his work is awesome. Just recently, he sat in on a kind of a COVID denialist webinar, and I watched the video. It's quite interesting. So if you guys can give that a watch, I'm sure you'd enjoy it.
That was so fun to watch.
incredible, really.
Yeah. Yeah. It was very good. I'm not going to spoil it. I'm not going to tell you anything, but it's just great. Like, you just go into a webinar with people who don't believe science and you throw science at them and they don't know what to do.
They freeze up. It's really bad. Oh, I also wanted to mention that Dan already appeared on Talking Biotech. Well, he already recorded it, so you can listen to it tomorrow, which is 5:22. You can listen to the Talking Biotech episode where Dr. Dan Wilson talks a little bit with Dr. Folta.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah. Check out the, I don't know, the sister podcast, if you will, of this one, because Kevin does a great job on that as well. Well, before we go, let me tell you guys to check out the Alliance for Science. And if you're a longtime listener, you're going to know about the Alliance, but they're based at Cornell University. They talk about recently vaccines as well, but they've been great on genetic engineering and agriculture, particularly in the developing world, because as we've talked about on the show, you have activist groups in Africa and Latin America that are trying to dissuade those countries from utilizing genetic engineering to improve the sustainability of their agricultural sectors. And Alliance for Science is great on that stuff. They have people like qualified scientists and reporters all over these countries reporting in real time on what's going on. So check out their work. They're at Science Ally on Twitter. So check them out. And then follow us as well. I'm at Cam J English on Twitter. And then Ali, you're on Twitter and you're on YouTube as well. So give everyone a plug for what you're doing.
Sure. So my Twitter handle is at Ali Answers, Ally Answers. And my YouTube channel is under the same name. And if you feel like reading my article about the AstraZeneca clotting incident or anything else that I have on there, you can visit my website at ali-answers.com.
Good stuff. Well, check out Ali's work. I'm sure we'll hear more from her in the future. And thank you guys, as always, for joining us. And we will see you next week.